And thank you, Nathan. Welcome, everybody, to this slightly truncated version of Midday. We're going to pivot from Israeli-American relations to the world of science and a very important report that was announced and released just yesterday. The National Academies of Sciences and the National Academy of Medicine issued a groundbreaking report called Human Genome Editing: Science, Ethics, and Governance. It suggests guidelines that would control how scientists might be able to add, remove, or replace DNA in humans. Now, some approaches to genetic modification in humans are already allowed in what's called non-heritable applications, and they use it to research, treat, and prevent congenital diseases and disabilities. But what's known as germline genome editing is not allowed, because modified genes wouldn't only be in one person, they would appear in that person's offspring. So making people stronger or smarter or with any number of other enhanced traits may be possible, but at the moment, it's not permissible. I'm Tom Hall. Dr. Jeffrey Kahn is here to walk us through this very complex topic that is rife with implications for all sorts of use and abuse. He is the director of the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics. He stops by Midday from time to time to talk about how ethicists help us frame questions around research like this, which not many years ago was unimaginable outside of science fiction. He served on the Committee on Human Gene Editing, and he joins me now to talk about the deliberations that led to yesterday's report. Jeff Kahn, welcome back to the show.
Good to be with you.
So this is important. It's animated in large measure by this thing called CRISPR, C-R-I-S-P-R, which is Clustered Regularly Interspaced Short Palindromic Repeats, which is a big mouthful, but this basically means it's a technique that allows scientists to do things easily and somewhat cheaply that they were just never able to do before. What can they do with this new technique?
So that's right. It's a technique that was discovered in bacteria, which seems to have evolved to help bacteria fight off infection. And so it was discovered sort of accidentally and has a feature that allows very precise and very controlled snipping of DNA in a place just where you want it and bringing in replacement DNA just where it needs to be. So it's much, much more precise and controllable and, as you said, cheaper to use and easier to use than any of the tools to modify genes up to this point. So it's a real breakthrough technique, I think is the easiest way to say it, a new tool.
And let's step back a little bit and even talk about some of the terminology here. Some folks call it genome editing. Others call it gene editing. Your committee actually took up what the proper technology should be. What did y'all decide?
So we said genome editing rather than gene editing, just because it's a way of altering all of the genetic information in a individual organism. So when you say gene editing, it tends to underplay the impact and importance. So that's why we chose genome. But we'll see whether the scientific community picks that up and persists, or it has a sort of looser set of terms. But I think everybody's meaning the same thing.
So genome editing, and then there's this thing, germline editing. And there are folks who say that if this is allowed, or when this starts happening, we could run the danger of creating a whole generation of genetic haves and have-nots. Why is that? What's the importance of and the ethical? What are the ethical ramifications of germline editing?
So the distinctions between somatic cell, which are the cells that are in our body, except for those that help us procreate. And those are the procreation cells are germ cells, sperm and eggs. So if you modify somatic cells, liver, muscle, heart, eye, then the changes in those cells die with the person when that person dies. But if you change sperm or eggs, then those genetic changes are passed on into the offspring of the individual who's been modified and then all of their offspring and into perpetuity. So germline editing is more, or germline modifications are more worrisome in a way because they introduce these future intergenerational effects, which effectively are population level effects if you do that to enough people. And it's sort of the genie out of the bottle problem, right? Fine, if you want to be modified as Tom Hall, if it works, good for you. And unfortunately, that effect won't be passed on to your future offspring. But if it doesn't work, which is maybe the bigger concern, it also won't be passed on to your future offspring. And so the issue is really more about what happens in the future rather than to the individual.
And that really does literally change the genetic makeup, or could change the genetic makeup of the human race.
With enough of the population affected, yes. Now, and people who do population genetics will tell you it's not something that a very small handful of people can have a big effect on the population, at least not for a number of generations, and generations take a long time, you know. But in thousands of years, sure, that could be true. If it were more widespread, then it could have a big effect. There's another technology that we're not talking about in this report that I will just say these words, which is gene drive, which is used now, being used and discussed as a technique to be used in plants and animals, which allow the spread of a genetic change to go much more quickly into a population. If that were ever introduced in humans, then we would have a real conversation about population level effects. But that is not being proposed in human populations at all.
I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to a shortened version of Midday. We shortened our show today so that NPR could bring you live coverage of the press conference with Prime Minister Netanyahu of Israel and President Trump. I'm speaking with Jeff Kahn. He is the director of the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute for Bioethics, and we're talking about a report released just yesterday concerning genome editing and germline editing. Jeff, let's talk about some of the current uses for this somatic cells, this non-heritable genes, in other words, genes that aren't passed on to somebody else. There are people, for example, who suffer from cancer for whom chemotherapy or radiation doesn't work, but by doing some altering of that person's genetic makeup, you can actually lead to a cure. Are they doing that kind of research? I mean, how are they using the somatic cell editing currently?
So there are techniques which are now termed gene transfer or gene therapy, which are attempts to effectively repair genetic mutations that cause disease. So the examples that people are probably most familiar with are things like sickle cell disease, which is a genetically inherited genetic disease, mostly affects African Americans, and it's quite devastating in its physical manifestation. So you could remove some of the cells from the body, do some gene editing on those cells, and put them back into the individual in a way that would repair the genetic defect that causes sickle cell. And that individual then would be treated and maybe even cured if this works as well as people hope. But their offspring would still inherit the trait that causes sickle cell in the parent, right? So that's the kind of approach. So cystic fibrosis, muscular dystrophy, sickle cell disease, certain kinds of inherited errors that cause immune deficiencies, something called SCID. There are targets of inborn errors, as they're known, single gene defects. Cancer, probably more complicated, but easily could be afforded by, you know, attempted to be treated by these kinds of approaches. So things that are genetic could be fixed. That's pretty much the take home. And we are trying to do, scientists have been trying to work on this using much less precise and controllable tools up till now with somewhat limited success. So now we're crossing a threshold where the techniques are going to be much, much, much better.
So let's talk about controllability and precision, because one of the taboos against making changes to human sperm or eggs, this germline editing that we're talking about, the ban on that, if you will, has been in place because there are some fears that it could go wrong. Something could inadvertently happen, and we could even create new diseases. What's your take on that? What the committee think?
That's exactly right. So the prohibition, which has been frankly worldwide, has mostly been focused on safety and uncertainty. So too much risk and too uncertain. So then we can talk about ethics, right? Once we get past these two what seemingly technically insurmountable concerns. And so these tools, in one fell swoop, seem to kind of surmount those technical concerns. So now we're confronted with the societal, ethical considerations. And so the committee thought very hard about this and wrote in its report lots of pages around how to think that through, and came to the recommendation that for a very, very small list of diseases for which there literally are no alternatives, and we can talk about what alternatives there might be, which are devastating, and for which you do very, very carefully controlled clinical trials, it may be something that would be permissible with a lot of public conversation. So we didn't say, go ahead and do that now, but rather set the roadmap, if you will, for how to go forward once a number of very stringent criteria are met. First and foremost of which is showing that it's safe and works well in non-human models. So you need to go through animal research first. So we're many years out before this could even be considered. But as we get to the point where it can be at least hypothetically considered, we thought it was time to engage the societal and ethical issues. And we said there could be examples where it would be acceptable.
There's an organization called the Center for Genetics and Society, which is bills itself as kind of a watchdog group of all things genetic. And they try to position this topic in terms of social justice. And they are basically in support of a continued complete prohibition of any even consideration of doing this germline editing. Why is prohibition not... a good option moving forward?
So it depends on sort of from what perspective we're asking that question. If one were to argue that there are strong moral concerns such that prohibition is in order, then we might try to institute some kind of a worldwide ban. Our committee did not think that was appropriate. So that's one. It's sort of what do you think the moral dictates are? If you think the problem is it's going to be available to some and not others, then you work on the equitable distribution problem, which is a little bit of what that entity, Marcia Darnofsky and her colleagues, focus on. The third question is, well, if you were to say, let's institute a prohibition, what will you get? A much more sort of realpolitik, a practical policy question. We can only look at what's happened in the past. Prohibitions tend to drive people who want to do things underground and out of the light that shines on them through regulation and policy and control. So we talked another time about mitochondrial replacement and what's happened with the prohibition in this country on going forward with that particular technique. It has sent American researchers to Mexico to subvert American prohibition. So prohibition tends to have unintended consequences. That's the short answer to your question.
People refer to it as medical tourism. You shop around for places that don't have restrictions like the United States, and you do it there. Because there is the possibility of doing what they call enhanced traits. I got to give you about 30 seconds to talk about what those are. And what would that mean?
So the difference there is between treating or curing, preventing disease, and doing something that would make somebody faster, stronger, smarter. And so the line between those two is harder to draw than one might think from the way I just said it. But that's the distinction. So how do we make sure it's used only for treatment of disease, disability, prevention, and not used to make people 10 feet tall or, you know, muscle bound?
So-called designer babies. Parents could order up a kid who's tall and athletic and muscle bound.
Exactly.
All right. We didn't get a whole lot of time to talk about this today, but next time you're back, we will certainly continue this conversation on a very important issue. Thanks so much, Jeff Kahn.
Sure.
Appreciate it. Jeff Kahn joins us from time to time to talk about issues in bioethics. He's the director of the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics, and we've got a link to the institute at wipr.org/midday. That's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, Living Questions, our series that explores the role of religion in the public sphere in advance of a series of lectures on confronting Islamophobia sponsored by the Institute for Islamic, Christian, and Jewish Studies here in Baltimore. We'll talk about the politics of exclusion and the invidious ways in which some try to marginalize Muslims in American society. That's coming up tomorrow here on Midday. Lunch today was provided by the Baltimore Chef Shop on the Avenue in Hamden. They offer a variety of private events and cooking classes for kids and adults, including baking and international cuisines. Tonight, it's a couples cook on Indian cuisine. Tomorrow, they're talking Korean street food. And on Friday night, couples will be cooking Sichuan food. More on the web at BaltimoreChefShop.com. On behalf of the entire Midday team, I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us for this shortened version of the program. We will see you tomorrow at noon. Have a great day.